Welcome. This is Poetry on the Move. In this episode, the panel The Science of Poetry, recorded at the Poetry on the Move Festival, held in Canberra in 2019. It's a common place that science is interested in objective and provable facts, while poetry is subjective, charting human experience and sensation. But this view neglects the many centuries in which poetry has responded to dazzling insights of the new philosophy, as John Donne called it, and science has explained itself with metaphor and intimations of the unknowable. In this panel, we ask a group of scientifically inclined poets how science works in and through their poetry, and what poetry can offer in understanding a changing physical world. Our first speaker is Catherine Coles. Catherine Coles' seventh collection of poems, Wayward, was published in June 2019. Coles has received a number of significant grants and fellowships and is a distinguished professor at the University of Utah.
She wonders whether scientists invested in provable facts become irritable when poets get things wrong. With me, she can't stop looking out the wall-sized window, one hawk, then another rising on an updraft. What does irritate scientists? I am interested in reality, in what we know and how. Also, I want every word to sing and mean as much as productively possible, maybe more. Dickinson says, to make a prairie, it takes a clover and one bee, describing an experiment in which scientific inaccuracy dazzles however you look. Even as the poem plays on gestures drawn from science, it investigates how the assertions of science at once embroider and unravel their authority. Rigorous and pointless self-correction directs us precisely to the point. The dreamy and uncontrollable, even when biologically impossible, propagation of meaning. A scientist may pretend not to care about charm, or impossibly want a word not to propagate to mean only one thing, or not. Like poets, scientists also want this and to place quarks and strange attractors at play in the fields of language. Metaphor allows Einstein to imagine a bowling ball on a trampoline and reconceive gravity. Even Darwin, old stickler, indulged in linguistic rhapsody. In the van in Punta Arenas, oceanographer Andrew Cullen happily tells me the viruses he harvests into Antarctic waters might look very different from those he sees in Hawaii. How then will he know what he's seeing? Not just having the feeling my mind mutters, but being able to name it. He talks about minute features, intuition, how an animal that looks exotic, even alien, might yet share a bump or hair with a creature he's seen. Likeness to hook it to, I murmur inwardly, to draw it from the netherworld where everything lives until it has a name into this one. I have found what I came for. When he asks who I am, I tell him, a little sheepish. Hey, everyone, he shouts into the van, I've got the poet. 6 days later, adrift in a slow-leaking zodiac with Andrew and his PhD student Chris, I crouch in icy water preparing flasks for samples. Suddenly, we are all surrounded by penguins, skimming the sea on all sides, arcing gracefully, until in an unexpected splash, one pops up and lands on the boat at my elbow, gazes at me. We all gaze back. After 20 long seconds, it vanishes back into the water. In the coming days, penguins visit me a half a dozen times, landing beside me to linger. My last week, early by the calendar, but just in time for me, the humpbacks arrive, a pod rising around us, rolling, huffing, watching. At dinner, the scientists jokingly vie to take me on the water. Andrew claims a poet's presence has convinced the animals we are worthy of their study. This hypothesis remains untested. Charismatic Diatoms, which lives on Andrew's department office door, begins in seeing a map of the sky through the microscope. This slide we bend to, blazing with ray shot heads, explosive as novas. Like my friends in science, I entered a state of wonder, as in awe, as in not knowing. On glacier or water heaving across the Drake, I have put myself in danger for nothing but seeing. I think of my friend Nalini, who studies trees, lifting into high branches on a harness that one day failed her. Light enters the eye. The mind creates what it sees. On childhood summer days, banished from indoors, I'd climb the old pear tree with a book and drift among the leaves, where, as my mother no doubt planned, rocking wind and the hum of the hornets sipping at fallen fruit distracted me. Back home in the present, my interviewer watches a third hawk rise from the canyon, harried by a magpie, lifting apparently without intent, because it can. Near the end of my time on the ice, I gave a reading, including a poem in which a rainbow-colored creature arcs through dream waves, part bird, part fish. Alice, a young biologist, quizzed me about method and rigor, about our shared interest in observation and my own in the nature of perception, how the lenses we use, literal and epistemological, shape how and so what we see. The next day, Alice stopped me as I emerged, dripping from the shared showers. "I saw it," she said, "your creature." The photo on her phone showed a floating figure, part bird, part fish, all sea ice, crystalline, because unlike glacier ice, it contains no bubbles, a fact. Important, unimportant, my dream, what Alice saw and how, our creature floating, eerie and aglow, its spine and head, an extravagant tail lifted from the water so elegantly, it must be curious. The shape they make, the shape they fill, Tom Lubbock says about Blake's bodies, is essentially what they are. Through and around my phone shooting video, I watch a penguin cross a zodiac. With binoculars so powerful they make me seasick, I look into the eye of a whale a football field away. Later, I bend to a microscope and see diatoms as constellations. Am I looking up or down? On ice, in treetops, danger is not great, but real. Once a scientist died at Palmer. They set him out on the glacier until the boat returned a month later. Like any investigator, I enter spaces out there, measure space within. Dickinson studying her garden, Blake in his coming forth naked to greet his friends. All like Blake's bodies, like divers in a perfectly free medium in which gravity doesn't apply. As Nalini knows, gravity applies. Her lean bones mended after long months, she rises again into the branches, her bright socks still unmatched. What do we mean by right? Split the lark, Dickinson says, and you'll find the music, bulb after bulb in silver rolled. Don't let gilding distract you. It's a dissection, a scarlet experiment, literally. To propagate metaphor and all her ironies, she makes the cut, then won't stop looking.
Tricia Dearborn is an award-winning poet whose work has been widely published in Australian literary journals, as well as in the UK, the US, Ireland, and New Zealand. Dearborn's previous collections are The Ringing World and Frankenstein's Bathtub, and her third poetry collection, Autobiochemistry, was published in 2019. Tricia.
I just want to say before I start, what you said about the light going into the eye and then the brain, it just reminded me the other day we had our niece staying, and has anyone seen that thing on the internet, the dress that some people think is white and gold and some people think is blue and black? I'm a white and gold, and both the other two were blue and blacks, and it was just astounding to each be looking at the same image and have these completely different perceptions. You know, that's by the by. So I'd like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the country, the Ngunnawal people, and pay respects to their elders past and present. One of the things writing poetry does for me is help me make sense of life. What is life? How can I best survive it, live it, enjoy it? Also, what is it to be a human being? What is it to connect with other human beings and other creatures and the earth? It makes sense to me to use scientific concepts and metaphors and imagery in my poetry, partly because I draw on everything in my work, and science is part of my background, and partly because I've never thought there's a gulf between science and art. I think there's quite a lot of crossover between poetry and science. For example, a focus on conciseness and precision. I think they're both concerned with describing, in very different ways, how the world works. The science I love is chemistry, the science of stuff, of substances. I still remember my first chemistry lesson where I learned about the existence of the elements. The idea that there were these irreducible forms of matter captivated me. You can take a chemical compound, so not an element, a compound like table salt, say, which is sodium chloride, and you can melt it and put an electric current through it and separate it out into sodium and chlorine. But you can't do that to sodium, and you can't do that to chlorine. There's something about that that I find fascinating. I was interested in science from a young age. When I was 6, I had books on rocks and dinosaurs and light. I ended up studying science. I did a double major in chemistry and biochemistry. I went on to do honours in biochem, and then I worked in science as a research assistant. I did literature surveys, devised experiment protocols, designed equipment and had it built, ran experiments, wrote them up, and discovered I didn't like working in science. So then once I'd been out of science for a few years, I discovered that I really missed the language of science. You just don't hear people saying autoclave or laminar flow cabinet or automatic pipette if you don't work in a laboratory. That was the reason I wrote my first science-infused poem, which I'm going to read to you now. It appeared in my first collection, Frankenstein's Bathtub, in a section called Laboratory Days. Just a small warning, don't be put off by the title, because it's not all going to be like that. The title is actually the title of my biochem honours thesis. The biosynthesis of 3-nitropropanoic acid in Penicillium atrovinatum. Now you can relax. In my biochemistry honours year, while a lot of mould flourished in Erlenmeyer flasks, let me tell you what really happened. I grew my hair out. My lab partner fell in love with me. We drank cups of tea together while assays ran. I spent mornings in quiet, methodical concentration at the laminar flow cabinet, starting mould cultures, enjoying the Bunsen-heated ethanol haze. In the cold room, I balanced the centrifuge, set it spinning, returning to a world of relative summer to stand patiently helpless till my glasses unfogged. My supervisor's wife, who worked in a bookshop, got me a copy of The Colour Purple at staff discount. At home, when I should have been writing up, I lay in the sun by my desk and read. Handed my thesis in 2 weeks late. I didn't fall in love with my lab partner, and our friendship survived for 5 more years to founder on father rocky shore. My memory still retains the whir and clink of the magnetic stirrer, the acrid sweet smell of oven-dried mould. I still can't take a measurement just once. I read that that was published in a journal before it appeared in my book, and I read that at the launch of the journal, and a guy came up to me afterwards and said, "My wife's a biochemist, and after you read that poem, she turned to me and said, 'That's the first poem I've understood all night.'" So writing that included science started for me with nostalgia. I've also found myself writing science poetry, if you want to call it that, just because our lives today tend to intersect with science more than they used to. I'm going to read one poem from my second collection, The Ringing World, which might strike a chord with anyone who's had an MRI. It's called Scan. When you enter the room, the machine greets you with the gentle doof, doof of the liquid helium pump. Nothing that would prepare you for the harmonising jackhammers that set to once you've been slithered feet first into its belly. I see nodding at the back there. Industrial headphones barely make a dent. The music that's meant to calm you pipes in pathetically in between scans. A few notes of Bach or Handel before humanoid voices break in to intone at incredible volumes. Bada, 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 bada. Now, 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 now. You wonder if the knowledge gained is worth being almost encased in a looming metal donut, soused in huge and rapidly shifting magnetic fields. This intermittent onslaught of sound, the unpleasant electrical crawling sensation in pelvis and genitals and over the skin, which the radiologist assures you you did not feel and do not still feel over arms and hands days later. Science plays a more explicit part in my third collection. In April 2011, I drafted a poem called Iron, and soon after I was writing a long sequence of poems with each poem linked to an element of the periodic table. This was a way I could unleash my love of chemistry and the elements and put it in the service of what is a mainly autobiographical sequence of poems. I called the sequence Autobiochemistry, which is autobiography mashed together with chemistry with that little hint of biochemistry. And it eventually became part of and gave the title to my third collection. Flukily, Autobiochemistry was published this year, which just happens to be the International Year of the Periodic Table. But I didn't know till after it came out. Many people ask me if I was writing a poem about every element. You know, anyone who's seen the periodic table knows there's quite a few of them. To which my answer was no. There are currently 118 elements, although they keep synthesising new ones at the far end of the periodic table. But the main reason was that I was only using elements that have strong associations for me or have some direct connection, either literally or metaphorically, to my life. Also, I had no interest, absolutely no interest in writing about the radioactive elements, of which once you get around number 80, quite a few. The radioactive elements are not irreducible and in fact can transmute from one element into another as they decay, which is sort of interesting in itself but not as interesting to me. The science in these poems is sometimes practical, material, descriptive, and sometimes metaphorical, and sometimes both. The beauty of science is in there too. So I'm going to finish by reading three poems from the sequence Autobiochemistry. The first one is called Hydrogen. So this poem draws on a number of scientific concepts like hydrogen bonding with oxygen to form water, water being the basis of the human body, and the biological concept of homeostasis, which is the body keeping everything in a state of dynamic balance. Hydrogen. Most of Earth's hydrogen is not free in the atmosphere, diatomic, but tethered to oxygen in water, the human body's solvent. Conceived in oozing warmth, we grow in a sealed-off sea. Once born, we require regular watering. In the name of homeostasis, our bodies regularly wring us out. Besieged by infant need, surprised by sorrow, laughter, eros, we brim, we drip. The next one is called Gold. Some of you may know that during World War II, two German scientists managed to save their Nobel Prize medals, which are made of gold, by sending them to the Niels Bohr Institute in Copenhagen. And then the Nazis actually came to Copenhagen and the chemists were like, how are we going to, we'll hide them, they'll find them. They dissolved them. Now, gold is an extremely stable element and there's only one thing that actually will dissolve it. And it's a solution called aqua regia, which is three parts hydrochloric acid and one part nitric acid. For me, conceptually, this is also linked to the phenomenon of people protecting themselves from trauma through making themselves invisible in various ways. The poem's in two parts. I'm just going to say one and two before each. So gold, one. Gold does not tarnish. Tutankhamun's death mask glows as on the day it was lowered to his emptied, resined flesh. It resists most chemical assaults. Aqua regia, a fuming union of savage acids, will dissolve it. So too Nobel medals, sheltered in plain sight. A flask of orange solution on a high laboratory shelf. The duration of a war. Two. On my way into the shop, I stumble, bend to retrieve the impediment, a handful of thrumming pleasure. The owners say nothing but trouble. I add the cost of her to my milk and bread. Fed, belly comically swollen, a paper ball chaser. Teased, a small spitting warrior. In scarred lip, wasted limb, matted fur, scurfy skin, behind the cloudy blinded eye, something immune to the onslaught, incorruptible. So this is the last one I'll read, and it's called Sodium. Sodium, the poem, begins with chemistry, moves into biology, a little bit of neurobiology, and it's all in the name of exploring how humans connect. Sodium. A metal so light it floats. A metal you can cut with a knife. A metal never found free in nature. When a shaving is pared away, sodium's cut surface shines glorious silver, but tarnishes in seconds, that incredible luster transformed to the dull grey of sodium oxides. Heated in air, sodium burns with a brilliant golden yellow flame. Tossed into water, it explodes. Neat sodium must be swaddled in a non-reactive substance, stored under kerosene, under oil. I wanted to be the pure metal, solely myself, self-sufficient, swaddled in the safety of needing no one. Now I know we're never pure, beginning as we do, as admixture, a dollop of the genetically new, from the outset chemically intermingled. Then we separate, but never completely. Even when we feel entirely alone, our mirror neurons prove us liars, firing when we see the other damaged or delighted, as if it were our hand poked with a blunt needle or stroked by another's hand. I grew up in a house of liars, a house of people, a house full of people pretending to be separate. But humans are never found free in nature. It's how we're designed. Connection as vital as oxygen. Intermingled, impure, we shine. Thank you.
That was Tricia Dearborn. You've been listening to the panel, The Science of Poetry. Our next speaker is Anne Elvey. Anne Elvey, author of White on White and Kin, is managing editor of Plumwood Mountain, an Australian journal of eco-poetry and eco-poetics. Living on Bunurong country in Seaford, Victoria, Anne holds honorary appointments at Monash University and the University of Divinity.
I'll briefly address the prompt that Paul sent about conversations between science and poetry in my own work. Around three headings, background, ancestry, and climate change. And okay, so where should I begin? In 1977, I completed an honours degree in pure mathematics at Monash University. My son is a pure mathematician doing a postdoc in Bordeaux. So a love of mathematics is a significant thing in our household. I've always felt that there is a link between the beauty, as well as the apparent uselessness in immediate economic terms, of so-called pure sciences, pure mathematics and theoretical physics, or mathematical physics, for example, and their marginalisation, and the same sorts of things in relation to poetry. It is rare, though, that my mathematical studies consciously enter my poetry, and I can attest to the fact that if you stop doing pure mathematics in the 1970s, you lose a hell of a lot of it. It's something you need to practice to keep. So I don't understand what my son is doing. I understand the words, but I don't understand how they fit together. I have one example, though, where mathematical ideas such as complex numbers become a metaphor for something unknowable. That might be a divine other, but might also be the more than that can be apprehended of the ground, soil, earth that sustains us, but also of the difficulty of knowing the good in a complex world. The final word of the poem is GD, so not a word, and it's meant to stand in without vowels for all these, I guess with an echo of the Hebrew not having vowels for the divine name. But for all these, and none, in lowercase, God, ground, good. So I'll read that. Being neither God nor ground nor good. The eye of complexity is more than the real that saturates the line. This could be mathematics, where an E and a pi exceed our capacity to write them, like a life, like this universe that for all its betweens, coordinates stressed, stretched across Cartesian undulations, seems calculable. Yet this line, ancestral with an infinity I could dive into, stretches to fold on fold of surd and sign, an insoluble problem, or the elegance of a moment when our Congress turns to this continuity with things that bend us round, moulded to the string of time, while all our curves and angles intersect with good. So ancestry. Cosmological, evolutionary and earth sciences offer us long views of ancestry. Gwen Harwood has a poem, Mother Who Gave Me Life, where she looks backward in time to those other bodies, your mother and hers and beyond, speech growing stranger on thresholds of ice, rock, fire, bones changing, heads inclining to monkey bosom, lemur breast. So not Gwen Harwood, but I have a poem reflecting on the experience of having a parent in aged care, and I'll just quote a couple of bits of that. It's called Ancestry. In a rare ANOVA moment, the elements are pressed in the dying star for the bones and the breath. Later, describing the way aged care is marked by time routine, the poem speaks of the slow dispatch of time, rostered, segmented like the hours. This is no monastery. This chiming life is descended from the stars. The dying matter of things is the slow bearing forth of cells, the astral pulse that falls inward, excess of history's eons in the flesh. And the third thing I was going to discuss or speak a little bit about is climate change. As a poet with a bent towards eco-poetry and eco-poetics, the sciences that exercise me are the sciences of climate change, biodiversity, and the ecological entanglements of living systems. And I'm sure that I'm going to be guilty of the sorts of things that your question was about, whether poets use the science, incorrectly or badly. So though I'm not well versed in any of the science, they enter my poems alongside other cultural inheritances such as art, music, and religious traditions. So I'm going to read a poem that Jess Wilkinson was published in Rabbit, which was nice. So Jess is over there, called Earth Interview in the Anthropocene. It's an alphabetic poem and it's founded on the conceit that Earth might speak back in human language. Earth Interview in the Anthropocene. An alphabetic language is not mine. It was always mine. Before you spoke, before you wrote it. A language in which you asked me to speak about climate, one of my truer tongues. You did not invent it any more than you did dinosaurs. You might be thinking that I only react to outside events, asteroids, meteorites, humankind, your few fallen into prosperity. I act with the grace of my law. It is not human. I do not resist, nor do I conspire. I am always the more that you cannot escape. This is joy and jeopardy for you, that the things you require, you kill. What is it like, you ask me, to be under the Anthropocene like you? You have read the Enuma Elish, how even the mighty ancient gods had unruly children. I do not call you my children. The relationship, our relationship, is more complex. Parenthood is a cliché proffered to simplify. It is a cliché to say you arrived late after many emergence, lateness a quality you took for first place, as if you were last, would last, outlast a ration of being. If you ask me, it is like the Shiva riding at speed. I throw up cyclone and storm, hurricane, typhoon, languages for them, drought, fire, each in its place, not undoing cycles. They were always infused with chaos. But the vigour has changed, is ever changing. I am changed. Weather is my stirring cloak, your X-rated news, my habitat, my atmosphere, and yes, yes, you are right to notice the difference, to consider zoology, to recall your zooid entanglements, your species of geology. As an editor, I'm interested too in poems that engage with the way scientists work. In the recent issue of Plumwood Mountain, in her poem Science Communication, Michaela Keeble looks at the gendering of science and modes of communication that distance or engage hearers and or readers against the implied background of climate change denial. In our ebook, Hope for Whole, Poets Speak Up to Adani, Helen Moore's poem, Climate Scientist Speaks, concludes, and I thank Helen for permission to quote from her poem. When the media publishes my findings or I report with colleagues to Congress, there's always the hope that this time our work will make a difference. Mostly I feel as if I'm speaking with addicts on the subject of their habit, the harm it's doing them in others, the denial of this truth. Back home, I well up as my kids play at being adults, their make-believe shaped by the only world they know. The tears of scientists have also found a way into my poem Emergency, and I'll finish with that. 1. Snowmelt. Mind keeps an index of flakes, a jindabyne of evidence in an icy creek. Old habits spill over mossed files. 2. Rocks are keyed to the rapids of imagination. 3. Speed signs are semi-submerged. 4. In the reef, graffiti surprises. It is a washout. Grayscale of organisms whitening. Catch of breath as scientists sweep.
Bronwyn Lovell is an Adelaide-based writer. Her poetry is featured widely in literary journals, and she has won a number of awards both in Australia and internationally?
I've always loved science and space especially. I have a deep interest in the role of women in science, space history, and science fiction. Yesterday, Kai reflected on Toni Morrison's observation that a statement like, "the man walked down the road" implies a white man, and the writer must specify blackness to change the default colour of that image. Elite careers, especially those in the sciences such as astronaut, engineer, doctor, are likewise gendered male by default in the reader's mind unless specified as female. I was so excited to see that the guests on this science-themed panel were all female today. I'm going to read some poems about space, some true, some imagined, but even when I write science fiction poetry, I privilege the science and do my utmost to be true to the laws of physics and our scientific understanding of how the universe works. I don't find that being faithful to science restricts fictional poetry. Quite the opposite. I believe it enhances the work. Trisha, I don't consider the arts and sciences as existing on opposite sides of a spectrum at all. I think science is in many ways intrinsically poetic. Spectrum. We tend to focus on visual frequencies, but light is more than we see. It's a feeling. It touches us as heat, warms at the infrared. It burns, can fry your fragile cells to ash. Light hurts, lasers cut, X-rays fly right through you. Light is sound to tune into, ceaseless chatter broadcasting on bands beyond human ears. Stars thrum inside like drums, hum like the hollows of guitars, echo chambers resounding for millions of years, the deepest, darkest songs. Light is a sea sailing constantly. Heaven swells in waves. You are awash with light always. Light doesn't belong to the day. It rains all night from a trillion suns. We sunbathe in starlight. Next couple of poems are inspired by my father, who has become an amateur astronomer in his retirement using my old astronomy textbooks. The Emotional Astronomer. Cares for telescopes like mechanical pets. Camps out with cameras and an aching neck. Tints torchlight, dims his van brothel red. Waits for the earth to move, the moon to set. Props a director's chair for the fade to black. Can't factor his children's resentment. Accepts the conditions, won't ask the sky why, will not love a nebula less the tenth time, gets teary at a clear viewing of Alpha Centauri, feels things to which his wife won't relate, needs no chart to plot the now fragile arc of a retired accountant's amateur star, knows meteors will rain down consolation, Jupiter, a river pebble. Saturn, a silky stone. Astrophysics. Beside the telescope, I ask Dad if he ever tires of the same old objects, night after night, year after year. He says each viewing has its own quality, just as the particles in any breath of air are unique. He's checking in on constant friends as they rise and waltz across a ballroom sky, diamantes glittering, dress shoes shining, in a dazzling din that will never disappoint or grow dim. Hands snug in parka pockets, I ask if he believes that the pull of planets affects people, as astrologers claim. He says, bullshit. It's all too far away. But what about the moon, I say, and the way blood trails from women in tides? And how about UFOs? I'm keen to hear your thoughts on those. He says, if they're real, aliens are merely humans who found a way to fold space-time, disciples of Einstein. Huh, I grin. So you believe in time travel then? Look up, he says. You're doing it now. This one's from my science fiction verse novel, but I think it's true. Erecting rockets for the Scarlet Planet. Ms. Mars, would you have been judged so harshly if your globe had glowed another hue? Red for passion, aggression, and apparently the place Earthmen come from too. Astrology, pop psychology, so retrograde they can't know you at all. Backward star signs foretell no future. Your moons are never heated. Your rocks are all at rest. Volcanic outbursts are ancient past. The fire has died inside you. Now you scald with frost. If cells still seethe, you've kept them hidden deep in desert wastelands or craters cracked with cold. Your gentle storms sweep only dust, devoid of spit or spark. You've gone soft in your old age. Bit by bit, your hold on the atmosphere weakens, learns to let go. Now you know that everything fades, drifts soundlessly away. You do not fight it. You've grown comfortable with solitude. You realize men are more trouble than they're worth. You no longer envy your pretty young neighbor, Earth. But red is a risky color to flash across the night. Beware the interest it invites. This is about the Space Shuttle Challenger, 1986. Challenger, ascending for 73 euphoric seconds, we thought they'd got away. A second sun bloomed in the sky. Eruption eclipsed our ears, and I don't know whether that whine was spiraling rockets or a collective scream, but I do know it was the worst sound to ever howl through me. Later, I learned the crew must have survived initially, though it would have been kinder if they died in the blast. The cabin went ballistic, traced a perfect rainbow to its fool's gold end. Rudderless and wingless for 2¾ minutes eternity, the crew was conscious, toggling switches in vain, comms down, power out, recorder stopped, oxygen on. Hell, they could see death coming, but had no way to stop it and no one to tell. And I'll just finish on a couple of science fiction poems. Algorithms. Spaceship knows it carries complex biological cargo. Spaceship is coded to recognize specimen survival as priority. In the event of emergency or system error, spaceship will initiate safe mode. In the event of life support failure, spaceship will divert power from non-essential sources. Spaceship values life over propulsion, life over communication, life over life, where the first is greater in number or rank. In the event of total biological malfunction and unsuccessful revival, spaceship will depressurize cabin, cease ventilation, restore propulsion. Spaceship knows life is not everything. Moonbase. When we dock and open the airlock, the air is icy, but their welcome is warm. They are glad to see us, fresh from Earth, our skins bronzed like an exotic species. The lunarians are pallid, rivulets running purple and blue under translucent skin. So much adaption in so little time, already stretched taller without gravity compressing their spines, and their pupils have bloomed so wide they almost take up the whole eye. This is what living in lava tunnels does. It bleaches you, turns you white like witchetty grubs. The landscape is filthy, crisp as soiled snow, grey from a fresh fall of gunpowder. The sharp, scratchy particles are so fine they manage to find a way inside, no matter how hard the lunarians try to rid it from their suits and boots. The damned dust will not stay out. We take the plethora of pills the ship's doctor prescribed, but our immune systems still react violently to this strange world. We wipe at snot, squint through tears sprung from acrid scent and sulfur sting. The puffy-faced lunarians look tired and red-eyed, like they've been crying for years. The Martian map is grossly inaccurate. Utopia, Elysium, Valhalla, all misnomers. Astronomers named them that in error from Earth, looking out across the universe through rose-colored lenses in humanity's ceaseless search for paradise somewhere else. Now arrived in Eden, I can vouch for the lack of grass, that nothing is greener.
Finally, a panel discussion moderated by Paul Munden.
I'd like to pick up on a couple of things that I think everyone touched upon. Kate, you mentioned rigour. Rigour is something obviously that we demand to see in scientific research, but also is there in poetry. And Tricia, you talked about enjoying, you know, relishing using the vocabulary of science, and that's perhaps one way in which we can recognise, you know, the authentic texture of a poem. You know, we can actually see that it's done its homework. But in another sense, I think we value effortlessness, seeming effortlessness in a good poem. So I'm just wondering if each of you might like to say something more about rigour and how we recognise it in poetry, and whether it is indeed, you know, a key quality that we look for.
I have actually a little story about working alongside scientists that goes along with that. Some of you are aware that I worked with computer scientists to develop a program that visualizes sonic relationships in poetry. And we worked together for some time, and in the process, the computer scientists actually had to solve an open problem in computer science in order to make the program of any interest at all to the poets, because what the way we think about and use sound is so complex. So when they come and they say, oh, look, we can do exact rhyme, I say, so can I. As quickly as the machine, this is not of interest. And so we spent a long time figuring out what would be interesting to us, and then they had to solve a problem, a pretty major problem, in order to give it to us. And we'd been working together for years, at least a couple of years, when my co-PI in the project, Mariah Meyer, who's a brilliant computer scientist, I used the word rigor in relation to poetry, and she looked at me and she said, do you guys
require rigor. You know, and so here's a place where, and we did keep running up against these places where vocabulary was that they came in one day to announce that they had developed a new formalism. And I was trying to figure out what that was. And finally I said, in my field, formalism has a very specific meaning. Can you tell me? And they said, oh, we just sort of made it up. Right? And so I think that when we talk, and with poetry these days, I prefer to talk about vigor than rigor in poetry. But we all have the places in our work and in what we do where we are maybe more vigorous than rigorous or more rigorous than vigorous, but where we misunderstand each other, not because the other person isn't sufficiently rigorous, but maybe because our own rigor in some ways is at fault.
Okay, well, that makes me think of a couple of things, what you said, that was interesting. Which is that, yes, in terms of scientific rigor in poetry that involves science, for me it's crucial. If I'm reading someone's poem that involves science and I spot that the science is wrong, I'm sorry, I can't. It's like that when you're watching a movie and you have to have that suspension of, in that case, disbelief. This is more like you're kind of violating my belief in what you're writing about and I will lose interest. So, and when I was writing autobiochemistry, you know, a lot of the basic stuff I remember, but I haven't been working in science for many years, so I did a lot of research as well, which was just fun because I love reading about the elements. But I wanted to make sure it was all I caught myself in some egregious error at some point. I was like, oh, my God. So for me it's very important. In terms of poetry, I only really, well, being aware that not probably for all poetry, but for the kind of poetry I write and a lot of people write, conciseness and precision is very important as it is in science. But I only realised very recently how important accuracy is in my poetry. What I realise is that I might be using some wild, hairy metaphor to convey something, but I want it to convey the, it might be a concept, it might be an experience, it might be a feeling. I want my metaphor to convey that experience or concept or feeling as accurately as I possibly can. I don't have any control of how it's received at the other end, but I want to make sure that I do everything possible to render this, let's just say, experience in, as accurately as I can.
Oh, you've got the meal, sorry. Okay. The thing that's going through my head, and I was thinking about this morning when you and Kai were speaking, was somehow about how that keystone of science, experimental method, might intersect with poetry. And I'm not sure, so I'm kind of throwing it out there as a question. But I think we probably, writers do use a kind of experimental method in how they put things together. And in a way, testing out what works. And I guess that's kind of in the background of the rigor of science is this kind of slightly amorphous experimental method that a lot of people don't actually understand. So a lot of the climate denialism is partly around people not really understanding what a theory is, what a hypothesis is, what experimental method is. So I'm just throwing that out there because I'm not sure how the rigor... So I'm sidestepping the question a little bit. So.
Actually, that works in really well to what I was thinking, because I was thinking about the role of science communicators and how important they are, and I think that poets are the best science communicators, and I was once the cocktail entertainment at a science, like a space conference, and I heard one of the delegates who was looking at the brochure, the program, say, "Poetry? What wank is this? You know, how does that belong in a space conference?" And actually, it went very, very well. And that man came up to me afterwards and spoke to me. But I think there is this perception that poetry in the public, not for poets. We know that poetry is rigorous and that we are going to be looking at every comma and every word and each line. But I think that in the wider public imagination, that isn't known, and that poetry is seen as an airy-fairy thing when actually it's very concrete. And that's why I find science and poetry go so well together, and why just what Anne said about climate change, in this era more than anything, it's so important. We need it. We need to get to the heart, the poetry of the science, so that the public can have an emotive response to the facts and what they mean for humanity.
I also wanted to say something really quickly about something I referred to in my essay about the difference between scientific language and poetic language. And Tricia will know from direct experience that when you're writing a scientific paper, the point really is to make sure that to the greatest extent possible, and of course it's not possible, every word means only one thing. And this is crucial to the repeatability of the experiment, right, as we think about the scientific method. This was one of the conversations I had with Alice on the station when I was trying to talk about how with poetry what we want to do is not to limit meaning but to propagate meaning, but to propagate it as productively as we possibly can. And yet at the same time, like the scientist, we finally don't have ultimate control over how what associations the reader might bring to the poem or to a particular word or set of words. And so the meaning keeps propagating beyond us in a way that is very much intentional for poetry, but can really inhibit the rigor of science, the doing of good science. So the application of rigor is really different in one site than it is in the other site.
You've been listening to Poetry on the Move, with a panel from the 2019 Poetry on the Move Festival, The Science of Poetry. Thank you to our poets Catherine Coles, Tricia Dearborn, Anne Elvey and Bronwyn Lovell, and to Paul Munden for chairing the panel. This podcast is made possible by IPSI, the International Poetry Studies Institute, and the Centre for Creative and Cultural Research, Faculty of Arts and Design at the University of Canberra. My name is Shane Strange. Thank you for listening.